From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Pakistani author and playwright Tariq Ali is detained at Munich Airport. The Red Cross raises $500 million after the World Trade Center disaster, then announces it won't spend all the money on victims. And fundamentalism, an old friend and new enemy, a conversation with renowned Egyptian feminist writer and doctor Nawal El-Saadawi. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is now the second. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. bombers attack the strategic northern city of Mazar-e Sharif today, and U.S. jets targeted areas near the front lines and airstrikes coordinated with anti-Taliban fighters. U.S. planes also struck Kandahar. In the western Herat province, the Taliban news agency said U.S. planes dropped cluster bombs near several U.N. refugee camps. One person died after picking up an unexploded bomblet. And in other news of civilian casualties in Kandahar, U.S. fighter jets in a pre-dawn air raid hit a dispensary of the Red Crescent Society today, killing 11 people. Among the survivors, Dr. Obaidullah, who runs the Red Crescent facility in Kandahar and whose head, right hand, and left leg are in bandages from wounds he said he sustained in the raid. The doctor said 11 people, including patients and staff at the facility, had been killed and 6 wounded by the U.S. bombing. The chairman of CNN has ordered his staff to balance images of civilian devastation in Afghan cities with reminders that the Taliban harbors murderous terrorists, saying it, quote, seems perverse to focus too much on the casualties or hardship in Afghanistan. In a memo to his international correspondents, Walter Isaacson said, quote, as we get good reports from Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, we must redouble our efforts to make sure we do not seem to be simply reporting from their vantage or perspective. As more errant U.S. bombs have landed in residential areas, causing damage to such places as a Red Cross warehouse and senior citizen center, the resulting television images have fueled criticism of the U.S. war effort. Isaacson said in an interview yesterday, I want to make sure we're not used as a propaganda platform. He said, we're entering a period in which there's a lot more reporting and video from Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. You want to make sure people understand that when they see civilian suffering there, it's in the context of a terrorist attack that caused enormous suffering in the United States. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld acknowledged yesterday that U.S. soldiers are at a base inside Afghanistan coordinating attacks with the Northern Alliance. Northern Alliance officials say such coordination will increase in coming days and that Alliance forces are planning a major offensive to wrest the strategic northern city of Mazar-e Sharif from the Taliban. Human rights, electronic privacy organizations, a coalition is filing a Freedom of Information Act request for information about the people arrested or detained since September 11th. More than 1,000 people have been arrested or detained by the FBI, nearly all of them immigrants or people of Middle Eastern descent. The FBI has refused to release even the names of those detained, much less where they're being held or what they're being charged with. Lawyers and family members of detainees who've gone public report that the FBI has persistently blocked their efforts to contact clients and loved ones. British Prime Minister Tony Blair sought to bolster public support for the military action in Afghanistan yesterday, saying there's now a flood of evidence proving that Osama bin Laden was responsible for the attacks in the United States. This after a poll released in Britain showed a majority of the population supports a halt to the bombing. Blair also sought to muzzle growing criticism of the war from within the British Labour Party. Last week, a member of parliament launched Labour Against the War, a group of MPs opposed to the bombing of Afghanistan. An Afghan women's rights activist spoke before the UN Security Council yesterday, urging the council to ensure that the country's women are included in any peace negotiations. The activist, whose name is Jamila, heads an organization that helps Afghan refugee women in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. Her testimony came on the first anniversary of a UN resolution that committed governments, including Kosovo and East Timor, to include women at peace negotiations while protecting them from the abuses of war. Women and girls represent 54% of the Afghan population. Women have been totally excluded from ongoing discussions among U.S. and U.N. officials about a future Afghan government. And the House votes tomorrow on aviation security legislation. On October 11th, Senate voted 100-0 for a bill that makes all airport security screeners federal workers with the same professional status as customs or immigration officials. But President Bush and House Republican leaders have objected strongly to putting 28,000 screeners on the federal payroll and opening them to union representation. And finally, the story of anthrax continues in the United States. This is a concern to people all over the country. A New York hospital worker is gravely ill with inhalation anthrax yesterday as the widening list of victims prompted health investigators to wonder whether they've underestimated just how infectious the bacteria might be. The hospital worker became the first person in the country outside the news media or the postal service to be infected with the deadliest form of the disease. There's so much to see through, like our parents do more drugs than we do. Corporate parents, corporate town, I know every TV set that has a lid. They preach that I should save the world. They pray that I won't do a better job of it. Pray that I won't do a better job. So tonight I turn to just so I'd be understood, instead another voice said I was just too late and just no good. Calling Olsen, calling Memphis, I am calling, can you hear this? I was out here listening all the day, and then I will write this down, and then I will not be alone again. Yeah, I was out here listening. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. That Dar Williams, are you out there? This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. 2 days ago, Tariq Ali, a prominent Pakistani writer based in London, was arrested at the airport in Munich, Germany. His crime? Carrying a famous essay by Marx entitled On Suicide and looking Central Asian. Tariq Ali was eventually released, but his detention tells a useful story. Ali was arrested in Germany, whose Green Party foreign minister supports the bombing. He's a prominent example of the treatment that people from Morocco to Bangladesh have faced at airports, not just in the U.S., but in Europe, where racial profiling has become the norm. And Tariq Ali is a dissident who strongly criticized the attacks on Afghanistan and who was detained for carrying a book of essays by Marx, Germany's most famous dissenter. We're joined on the phone now by Tariq Ali, who has made it to London. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hi there, Amy. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you describe in your own words what happened?
Well, essentially, they started searching me, and they did a pretty thorough search. And I had newspapers on which I'd scribbled notes, which is my habit when something interesting strikes me, and they were trying to read these notes. So I handed them a copy of the Süddeutsche Zeitung, the leading liberal paper in Germany, and said, there's an article by me in this. It might be easier for you to read since it's in German. So they grabbed that. And started reading it. And then while they were doing that, a book which a publisher had handed me in German fell out from the Süddeutsche Zeitung, and they looked at it and nearly fainted, because the first thing they saw was the title, which is On Suicide. And they rushed and got the armed police. Then they noticed the author, who was Karl Marx, and this got them even more excited. And they then took me to the police headquarters at Munich Airport and said, don't think you'll be boarding that plane. I think we're going to question you. I said, if I'm not boarding that plane, I need to make a phone call to the mayor of Munich, who's a social democrat, Christian Jude. And they said, yes, what do you want to do with the mayor? So I said, I actually happen to know him. And he introduced me and interviewed me in public at a big bookshop on Friday, at which point they began to realize that this was the truth. And I said, could you please get him on the phone now so that I can inform him of what's going on? At this point, they let me go. So, you know, in sort of all in all, it was a trivial event, but it's very indicative of the mood there, because the Interior Minister, Otto Schily, is now pushing through laws which will give the German equivalent of the FBI powers to spy on any dissident. The actual formula used is spy on and observe people who are opposed to this peaceful coexistence of nations. And this, in newspeak, means those who are not in favor of government policies.
We're talking to Tariq Ali, just detained in Germany, made it back to London. You wrote a piece recently called Why the United States Can't Trust Pakistan. You did it for Pacific News Service in the United States. Why?
Well, I mean, the problem is this, that the Pakistan Army, and especially its intelligence services, and I've been writing this for 4 years now, Amy, in different publications, created the Taliban, trained them, educated them, and hurled them into battle to take Kabul. This is the only victory this army has ever won, which is the taking of Kabul via their proxy, the Taliban, and with lots of Pakistani soldiers and officers involved. So I just felt it'd be very difficult for them to unravel this victory. And I'm being proved right every minute. I mean, the head of the Pakistani military intelligence, sent by General Musharraf to try and split the Taliban so that a so-called moderate wing could be used in a future coalition, arrived at Kabul. This is General Mahmoud Ahmad. Told the Taliban to do nothing of the sort, said we're under American pressure to get you to do this. My advice to you is to stand firm and fight back. Of course, he was sacked when he returned, but this is symbolic of the close links between the Pakistan Army and the Taliban, and the close links between the military intelligence in Pakistan and various fairly hardline fundamentalist terrorist organizations, one of which, Jaish-e-Mohammed, killed innocent Christian people a few days ago in Bahawalpur. These are all groups which have received arms and money from the Pakistani military. So, you know, it's quite incredible to expect this or a large chunk of this army to deliver anything. That's my opinion.
Tariq Ali, what about the effect of the U.S.-Northern Alliance relationship and the offensive that's being launched right now on the Pakistan and on the stability of Pervez Musharraf, the Pakistani president?
Well, I think that if the Northern Alliance is placed in power in Kabul by the United States, it will really strain the relationship between the United States and General Musharraf, and certainly within the Pakistan Army itself. I mean, you've got to understand that for the last 10 years, this army has been fighting the Northern Alliance with the Taliban. So I think they will see that as a massive defeat for Pakistan if the Northern Alliance is suddenly put in power in Kabul. So, and it will create a very, very tense situation inside Pakistan itself, because the Northern Alliance has been receiving aid and help from India, not to mention Russia and Iran. So it's not a pro-Pakistani group. And I think Pakistan, that's why, are trying desperately to split a chunk of the Taliban so that they can be put into the coalition as well. None of this, of course, is going to work, because the notion that the Northern Alliance is better than the Taliban, of course, is a total joke. They're a bunch of gangsters and heroin dealers and heroin smugglers whose attitude to women is just as appalling, in some ways even worse than the Taliban. I mean, the Taliban at least stopped the mass rapes that were taking place and, you know, in a sort of their own extreme way, said that they would execute rapists and did. but the Northern Alliance actually are well known as encouraging mass rapes of people, women they capture, etc. So the notion that this so-called Great Alliance Against Terrorism and for Freedom has got these people on side doesn't inspire much confidence in any of the Western leaders.
Tariq Ali, you also did a piece called The Eichmann Scenario, An Alternative to War, and you've been speaking at anti-war rallies in Britain.
Hello?
Hi, I was just saying that you just did this piece called An Alternative to War, The Eichmann Scenario, and you've been speaking at anti-war rallies in Britain. Can you talk about that?
Well, the movement in Britain is now growing very big. We had an opinion poll published yesterday, which showed that a majority of the people favor a stop in the bombing. I think this is not a popular war in Britain. It's not a popular war in other parts of Europe. It's seen by growing numbers of people as a crude war of revenge, and most people believe that it's not going to achieve its stated purpose, which is to try and restrict terrorists, destroy their bases, and most importantly, stop the flow of young middle-class kids into these organizations. I mean, today, we've been saying this since September the 11th. This is not the way to do it. Today, one of the most famous authorities on war and strategy, Sir Michael Howard, an extremely conservative figure, has come out in Britain and said he sees no signs that the West is winning this war. He feels that the way this war is being fought is actually strengthening the enemy and is going to lead to a growth in terrorism. I mean, he said this in a big lecture yesterday. This ties in totally with what people like me have been saying from the other side. So I think if there is sanity around in the Western chanceries and in the State Department, they just should see that this is not going to help anyone, this particular war. It's wrecking a country, it's destroying its civilian population, it's destroying what little infrastructure there was, but that's not going to stop the growth of terrorist organizations or terrorist groups. Far from it. The only way you can even begin to do that is to understand the causes of what drives people to despair. And that means seeing the situation in the Middle East, seeing what's going on in Palestine, in Iraq, in Saudi Arabia, really needs a political solution. As far as those who carried out these acts, most, they're all dead. If there is evidence that they were given orders by Osama bin Laden or whoever else, the courts should have been told to deal with it and still should. Warrants should be put out for these people. They should be captured and brought to trial. And it should be done in a patient way. They should be stalked and found, as happened when the United States stalked and found Ramzi Youssef, who tried to destroy the World Trade Center 4 or 5 years ago. He was finally captured with the help of Pakistani military intelligence and brought to trial. Likewise, Mr. Kansi, who killed CIA officers outside Fort Langley in Virginia and disappeared. Pakistan helped to find him. He was also facing, he's also in prison in the United States, and a similar method should have been found for this criminal act, which took place in New York and Washington, not a war. This is why we were always nervous when President Bush declared we're in a state of war, because, you know, you're in a state of war when you're attacked by another country. This is a not very large group of terrorists, and you have to find them. You don't wage war on countries where they are, and then the war against one country in particular. I mean, most of the people who carried out these attacks came from Saudi Arabia. So if war has to be waged, which I think shouldn't be, it should have been against Saudi Arabia, not Afghanistan.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Tariq Ali, for joining us. Tariq Ali is a London-based author picked up in Germany at the airport, I guess, for being Pakistani. The author of NATO's Balkan Adventure and The Stone Woman, an Islamic Quintet, which has just been published. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to look here at home at the Red Cross and why the head of it was forced to resign, and how it is that about half of the tremendous amount of money raised in the wake of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon is not going to be spent the way the people who contributed thought. It won't go to the victims. Then we'll be joined by Egyptian doctor and feminist Nawal al-Sadawi. Stay with us.
Right from the start, in a world torn apart, a baby's love, his fingerprints upon the heart. So many think it, but never say it. Why bring a child to this planet full of hatred? They might not make it like the youngest departed. Worst of all, they might become a part of it. Involved in it, perpetuating violence, violence, growing up in silence. Seeing things they don't know how to deal with, and learning ways to try to cope with it, cope with it, cope with it. But not lose hope no matter where I roam. Well, well, we know every single soul is a poem. It's written on the back of God's hand. No matter where I roam.
Every single soul, Michael Franti and Spearhead, here on Democracy Now! War in Peace Report. We're broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the American Red Cross announced that it will stop asking for donations for victims of the September 11th attacks. The Red Cross's Liberty Fund, established after September 11th, held an unprecedented $547 million in pledges as of Monday. The Red Cross came under harsh criticism in the past week after revealing that it would not use much of the money it had raised to meet the needs of victims of the attacks. Many families and attack survivors have complained about the difficulty of negotiating the maze of different aid groups and report they've still not received assistance 6 weeks after September 11th. The scandal over the Red Cross's use of funds and the way in which it appealed for them helped force the resignation of Red Cross President Bernadine Healy. The controversy surrounding the enormous amounts of money raised by the Red Cross also highlights the impact that the September 11th attacks have had on charities around the country that attempt to meet the needs of the country's poorest and most vulnerable citizens. We're joined right now by Stacey Palmer, who's the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Can you tell us the chronology of events since September 11th that have led to the resignation of Bernadine Healy and the explanations of where all this money is going?
Yeah, part of that story is still unraveling to figure out exactly what has happened, and a lot of it was happening before September 11th when there were a lot of people who were very upset with the way Bernadine Healy was running the Red Cross, so this is a long story. But after September 11th, donations started pouring in, and everyone who was thinking about giving knew the Red Cross was working on the relief effort, and it was sort of an instant donation idea. You could give online. There were a lot of promotions for the Red Cross, so they started collecting an enormous amount of money, and not too many donors were asking questions about where that money was going and were just assuming that it was going to the victims. Later on, the Red Cross started to put out some partial explanations of where the money was going, but only after a lot of prodding, largely internally, but also from some outside critics saying, you know, where is this money going? What's going to happen with it? And when they announced that some of the money was going to go to things that would help the Red Cross prepare for the future whenever disasters happen in other places, other terrorist attacks, people got very upset and said, wait a minute, we never had any idea it was going to be going for future needs to help the Red Cross build its own infrastructure. We thought it was going to go directly to help the families. And that led to a great deal of public criticism that the Red Cross had to figure out a way to deal with, and I think that's one reason we saw Bernadine Healy resign.
What was the discussion that went around her resigning?
Clearly, there was a difference between her and the Board of Governors about that runs the Red Cross over what was the best way to collect these donations and what was then also the best way to use the donations. Should there be a separate fund where people could give to this so-called Liberty Fund that people were donating to? And the Liberty Fund was specifically for the attack, not the Red Cross's general relief fund, where they, you know, any kind of hurricane or natural disaster, those kinds of things that the Red Cross always responds to, you can give to this general relief fund, or you can give specifically to something that was called the Liberty Fund to help the victims and to help deal with the aftermath of the terrorist attacks. There was certainly some concern about whether Ms. Healy had the authority to create that fund on her own, or whether she had to get approval, and whether it was the right thing to do. And the reason this is such a controversial issue is that the Red Cross has been criticized in the past for not spending all of the money that it's collected in a particular area for a particular disaster on the needs in that area. It happened in California after the earthquakes there. It happened in Minnesota after some floods, and they actually faced a lawsuit from the Minnesota Attorney General about how they use the fund. So the Red Cross internally has been very sensitive to the fact that it can be criticized when it doesn't do the right thing about telling donors where this money is going to be used and using it for what it's actually collected it for. So there was a lot of pressure to change the way the Red Cross was responding, and that's what led to her departure.
Stacey Palmer, editor of Chronicle of Philanthropy. We're also joined by Daniel Borishoff, who's director of the American Institute of Philanthropy, which is a charity watchdog group that's based in Maryland. Daniel Borishoff, what about how the Red Cross advertised itself in this period since September 11th? I saw celebrity after celebrity, including Julia Roberts and others, encouraging people to give money to the Red Cross and to save a life.
Well, there was a disconnect between the advertising and what the Red Cross intended to do with the money, and it's quite unfortunate that this would happen, because if you saw the advertising specified that the money was for the victims, their families, and the relief workers, where it's looking like half of the money will be going for this purpose. They really should have cut the fund off a lot earlier than they did. They really should have cut it off after they had raised $250 to $300 million, and not, they were acting rather opportunistically by letting it go on for $550 million, because what you have here is that other charities are hurting as a result of this. Even local chapters of the Red Cross have had difficulty competing with the national office and have received less funding.
Can you talk about this history that the American Red Cross has? Stacey Palmer was just talking, for example, about Minnesota. The Red Cross in Minnesota being sued by the Attorney General there after the whole scandal around relief for the victims of the Red River Valley flooding
in
1997.
After a highly publicized disaster, money pours in, and the donors really need to watch and keep an eye to make sure that the Red Cross will spend the money for the purposes intended. There's about $4 million that the Red Cross finally did have to fork over and spend in Minnesota as recently as this March, and this hasn't even been investigated yet by the Red Cross. There were some wildfires out in San Diego area, and lots of money was raised, but only a small portion of that was reported to have been distributed in the area. So it's really important that donors get some follow-up when they give money to the Red Cross and see that the money is actually being used for what it's intended. And in this example, we're talking about, they want to lock away, they're talking about $250 million extra here than they've accounted for in their plans. So we want to watch this and make sure that they just don't sock this away, because they're saying that, you know, there may be other terrorist activities that they can use it for. Well, there may not be, and there's certainly the potential, as we've learned from this, to raise additional money. So we don't want to just let them sit on this. I mean, they need to have a reasonable reserve, but $250 million is a lot of money here.
I'd like to talk further about this issue of other organizations, for example, in New York, and the number of people who are suffering right now, unable even to get a month's rent and who are out of work. What impact the money that goes to the Red Cross and doesn't go to charities, other charities, is having on them? Are charities actually closing up?
Well, see, we got sucker punched by the terrorists in the nonprofit field because they hit us while our cash flow is lowest before the holiday time, when a lot of the money comes in, with the economy already faltering. Giving mirrors the economy, and what's happening here is the nonprofit groups are getting squeezed because the demands for their services are increased. You got all of these people that are getting laid off, all of these people that are paid very low, that are now finding themselves in a lot of trouble. So the nonprofits have greater needs, yet they're getting less money, partly because money's been directed to this crisis, and partly, but even more importantly, is because of the economy tanking. So it's a really difficult time, and people should really step forward and think about all of this great appreciation of wealth we've accumulated in our real estate and our investments over the past four decades, and at this time come forward, not give. Americans have been stuck over the last three decades to only give 2% of our income. This is the time we need to do a lot more and think in terms of giving.
We're talking to Daniel Borishoff and Stacy Palmer. Daniel Borishoff is director of the American Institute of Philanthropy, a charity watchdog group based in Maryland, and Stacy Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacy Palmer, can you talk more about Bernardine Healy? It's interesting, Bernardine Healy and Elizabeth Dole before her, well-known conservative activists who are heading this establishment organization, the Red Cross.
Yes, I think it is important to realize that the Red Cross has to be very careful not to get involved in partisan politics. And though it has happened that two well-known Republican leaders have been in charge of it, they really have to be very conscious to steer away from partisan efforts, or else the IRS will come in and say, "Wait a minute, that's not appropriate." So, I think their political connections in some ways have been important in terms of being able to connect them with the kinds of people that are involved in the Red Cross system. We obviously depend on this in emergency needs and cases. I think a bigger question for the Red Cross is when they choose their next leader is that they've had problems with both Mrs. Dole and Dr. Healy, and what is the next leader going to be like, and should they think about choosing a different kind of person than they have in the past?
Right now, with the crisis that exists in New York, I was just at a union meeting a couple nights ago of 32BJ, which is the building workers, people like the elevator operators in the World Trade Center, those that survived. And the crisis they're facing right now, undocumented workers, for example, those that survived, were working at the World Trade Center for more than a decade, and they have no place to turn, either because they don't have the documents that they need or the Social Security number to get regular aid, but even those that do are really not able to get that support right now. And as you were saying, Daniel Borishoff, there is this very serious disconnect. So you have the charities that are not getting money. You have the Red Cross that has a tremendous amount of money. What kind of conversation is going on between the charities for low-wage people in this city and for people who are suffering the most, like the undocumented workers, and the Red Cross that is holding on to these hundreds of millions of dollars? Daniel Borishoff?
Oh, okay. Thank you for asking Stacy that question. Sorry. Well, there other nonprofits are coming forward, looking, advertising their needs right here. There has become a more of awareness. People have been so riveted on this crisis, it's been very hard for them to think about other problems that exist out there.
Right, but can the charities get the money from the Red Cross, considering how much money they have? Like, is there any conversation about the money the Red Cross was just going to use to shore up infrastructure, the more than $200 million that they were going to divert from direct victim assistance, going to these other charities that are more grassroots and work more directly with the people in need?
Well, I think it would be a wonderful gesture if the Red Cross would agree to take take a portion of this money beyond what would be a reasonable reserve and redirect and go back to the donors. I mean, they could go back to some of their million-dollar donors and say, look, we overdid it here. Why don't we think about, there are some social and human service agencies really struggling right now. Would you give us permission to redirect it, to another organization that has a greater need for the money? That would be a wonderful gesture if the Red Cross would do that. I wouldn't suspect that they would, though, unfortunately.
Stacey Palmer, is there any kind of history of something like this? And if people are confidence is to be restored in the Red Cross, of forming some kind of coalition of philanthropies right now and redistributing that tremendous amount of money when you have so many people in need.
As Daniel said, it would be very unusual for the Red Cross to actually give up the money that it's raised and that it feels responsible for distributing. However, there are many other charities that are also working that have collected money. There's the September 11th Fund, which is actually working with a lot of grassroots groups in New York City to distribute money. I think this issue of the Red Cross rebuilding confidence is very, very important. A lot of people trusted the Red Cross and now feel that their trust has been broken, and the Red Cross is going to need to do something to make the donors feel much better. And I think it's also a question as to whether the Attorney General in New York will intervene and say this money was raised for the victims and it does need to go in some way to the terrorist aftermath, not the way the Red Cross has defined it, but much more specifically to help particularly in New York. So I think it is possible that, you know, right now nothing has happened in terms of a lawsuit, but I think it's possible if they don't move quickly that they could face one.
It just seems, to say the least, very ironic that at a time when you have the greatest need and such a tremendous amount of money that has been raised, so you actually could have a matching of the two, the need and a way to deal with it, that people are suffering more than ever. I was talking with an elevator operator who said she couldn't count how many times she had to go to simply try to get her September rent covered. And now there's October rent and November rent, and we're talking something like $400. And you match that up against the hundreds of millions that these organizations have raised to help people in this very situation. Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and Daniel Borishoff, director of the American Institute of Philanthropy. As we move now to our last segment, which is a conversation with Nawal El Saadawi. She, too, was involved with the medical profession, an Egyptian doctor. She was dismissed from her post as Director General of Health and Education, but this was in Cairo in 1972, and she was dismissed for her political activities. She's been unable to practice medicine in Egypt since that time. She also lost her job in the Egyptian government, and the magazine she founded was closed down. She wrote memoirs from the women's prison after she was imprisoned by Egyptian President Anwar Sadat for alleged crimes against the state. She was released 1 month after his assassination in 1981 because many of her works were banned in her native country. She's been published in neighboring Lebanon. The Arab Women's Solidarity Association, which Nawal El Saadawi founded, was closed down in 1991 for opposing Egypt's role in the U.S.-led Persian Gulf War. Nawal El Saadawi's writings on feminism and Islamic fundamentalism have earned her many enemies. She speaks openly about female genital circumcision, constantly criticizes religious fundamentalism, and calls for sexual equality in Muslim inheritance laws. Earlier this year, an Egyptian lawyer claimed that Saadawi, who's 70 years old, had shown she was no longer a Muslim in a March newspaper interview. He argued she should not be allowed to remain married to her Muslim husband and filed a suit to forcibly divorce them. In July, a Cairo court threw out a petition ruling that no individual could petition a court to forcibly divorce a couple. We're joined right now by Nawal El Saadawi, who is in the United States, in fact, in New Jersey. She is currently teaching at Montclair State College. We welcome you to Democracy Now in Exile. It's good to have you with us, Nawal El Saadawi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, it's great to have you there.
Yes.
Can you talk about where you were on September 11th?
I was here. In fact, I came just a few months before the 11th September to New Jersey for my teaching in Montclair State University. So I was just 9 miles away from the event.
And what were your thoughts on that day?
Well, my thoughts about this event that we have to look at it from the historical, from the past and the present, because those groups who are said that they did this terrorist act, Osama bin Laden and his group, they were encouraged and trained and financed by the U.S. during the 70s and 80s to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And they gained a lot of power because of that. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they turned their operations to our countries, to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and they were killing tourists and threatening writers, putting writers on the death list, etc. And nobody really, they were leaving them doing that. The U.S. did not interfere, even in paying them. And now when they started to turn against their father, who created them, the U.S., the United States government is now fighting them. So it's really, I look to religious fundamentalists, whether Islamic or Christian or Jewish or Buddhist, as part of the whole capitalist class patriarchal system, the global system. They are two faces of the same coin, religious fundamentalism and neocolonial capitalism. And we are suffering, we as women and we as poor people living in the so-called third world, in Asia, Africa, in the Arab world, we are suffering from both religious fundamentalism and from capitalism and neocolonial powers. And that's the problem we are facing now.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but when we come back, I'm going to ask you to explore that more and also talk about how your colleagues and people in New Jersey have reacted to you since September 11th. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll return in a minute.
So many struggles. So many we have lost.
We have lost
so many people.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Dr. Nawal al-Sadawi, who is a writer, has come to this country, is teaching at Montclair State University in New Jersey, and was there, had just arrived back in the United States when the September 11th attacks took place. We were just playing the music of Kim and Reggie Harris and Magpie, the song How Long. Nawal al-Sadawi, you're talking about the different fundamentalisms. You have long been critical in your own religion of Islamic fundamentalism and of how women's movements are shut out of Islamic political movements and state religion. You call fundamentalism an old friend and a new enemy that's infiltrated many government administrations in Egypt and other Middle Eastern countries. I wanted to ask you first about information that I actually just learned yesterday. We had heard about Mullah Mohammed Omar, the leader of the Taliban, that in the first days of the attacks in Afghanistan, that his 10-year-old son was killed. But it was only yesterday that we heard that his wife and his daughter were killed at the same time, yet there was no news of this in the United States. Had you heard about this, and do you have an explanation?
Yes, I heard about that, yes.
And why do you think that hasn't gotten the same kind of attention, yet his son dying had?
In fact, your voice is so low that I hear only half the praise. Can you raise your voice?
Yes, I'm sorry. I was just asking why there's been so little attention about his wife and his daughter having been killed in the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, although Mullah Muhammad Omar's 10-year-old son, we had heard in the United States about his death.
Well, I don't know. You know, the media of the capitalist system, of the class patriarchal system, whether in the West or the East, usually they pay attention more to men. Maybe they neglected the wife and the daughter, or maybe they didn't know about it, the news did not come. I don't know.
And what about the issue of Islamic fundamentalism and the Taliban's oppression of women being used as a justification of the bombing of Afghanistan? Certainly women have suffered terribly there.
Well, this is really, it annoys us because it's hypocrisy. Women were killed in Afghanistan by the fanatic religious groups, and they were also killed in many other countries, in Algeria and in many other places. But nobody spoke. And in Saudi Arabia, women are oppressed terribly, while the U.S. government was silent about the Saudi Arabia regime doing to women. And in Kuwait also, the U.S. was supporting Kuwait while women were oppressed in Kuwait. So now they are saying they are defending women in Afghanistan. Nobody believes that, because in fact they never supported women. It's just used as a cause to justify the war and the aggression.
Also yesterday at the United Nations, an Afghan women's rights activist spoke before the UN Security Council, urging it to ensure that Afghanistan's women are included in any peace negotiations. Her testimony coming on the first anniversary of a UN resolution that committed governments, including Kosovo and East Timor, to include women at peace negotiations while protecting them from the abuses of war. We've seen no indication that women are included in these negotiations that are going on right now between the United States, the United Nations, and in discussion with a post-Taliban regime.
Yes, women are ignored, neglected by all political systems, not only women, and also the poor, the working class, the lower classes are never mentioned. And who is killed now in the war? It's the poor people, the very poor, and women and children, the weaker sectors in society. So what I think also, the United Nations should really work for the people, not for the regimes and the governments. And people should be left to elect their government. Why should the U.S. interfere in other countries and appoint rulers and governments? So let the Afghan people be... I was listening to an Afghani woman who said, let's have our own government and we can elect our people. We are able to elect our people. So it's this continuous interference of the so-called superpowers and big countries in the West in our lives that spoil everything. And we know the reason. It's the oil and the money and the, you know, it's an economic problem, but concealed by some religious and some cultural problems.
What do you think right now must be done?
What must be done now that people, I am from Egypt, for instance, that people in Egypt, in Afghanistan, in Sudan, in Algeria, should be left alone to organize politically. And there should be no censorship to expression, to writing, to thinking, and to political organization. And not to close any organization because they disagree with the local regime. Because who supports the local regimes in our region? It's the U.S. government. They supported Sadat while Sadat was putting us in jail. They supported King Fahd in Saudi Arabia while he was oppressing women and the poor. So I think the U.S. should not support any regime in our region, should leave the people free to organize politically and to speak up and to change their life.
And what power do women in Afghanistan have right now?
Well, they have power. Of course, women have power. They are more than half the society if they are left alone. But they are never left alone. Like, women have power in Egypt, but we are not, we cannot, we don't have the freedom to organize freely. You know, that's the problem. We don't have democracy. We don't have real freedom so that different sectors in society can organize and can have their political and economic organization. So that, but the majority of people are silent. We call them the silent majority. The majority of people, men and women, are unable to organize because they are oppressed. They go to prison if they organize. So that's the main problem, the paralysis of the majority.
We're talking to Nawal al-Sadawi, leading Egyptian feminist, writer, psychiatrist, author of, among other books, The Hidden Face of Eve, Women in the Arab World. What do you think of the way Islam is portrayed by the U.S. media?
Very bad. I think I am here in the U.S., and I think how they select only Islam as the only oppressive religion in human history. Though if we compare the Quran to the Bible, for instance, or other holy books, we find that the Quran is much more flexible and liberal, even in relation to women. But there is a lot of bias. They try to conceal the economic reasons and the conflicts in relation to oil, exploitation of oil, the multinationals. They want to hide this conflict and bring up the most superficial religious and cultural conflicts. They also hide the problems of other religions. Why don't they speak about Christian fundamentalism in the United States? Women here are suffering from Christian fundamentalism. So it's not only Islamic fundamentalism that are really creating problems. There are problems by all different religious fundamentalist groups all over the world. But they specify Islam, which is very wrong.
You have written extensively about women under Islamic fundamentalism, but as you say, all fundamentalisms have been challenged. You've been imprisoned for this under Anwar Sadat. And I wanted to ask you about the neighboring country, Israel and Palestine, and how that plays into what we're seeing today in the bombing of Afghanistan and what position you take on that conflict.
Well, it's a tragedy, you know, the problem of the Palestinian people and the problem of the Iraqi people also, because, you know, what happened in the Gulf War. What's happening now that every day Palestinians are killed and they are facing the military power of Israel and the political and military power of the United States. And so unless really there is a solution that based on justice and peace and equal participation of Palestinians and Jews in the country, because it's the country of the Palestinians and the Jews, and there must be equal distribution of everything, of land, of economy. So, but the problem is not a Jewish-Muslim conflict. It's a conflict over land, over water, over material resources between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So there is no justice. So how can you expect peace without justice? And you know, civilians are killed in Palestine. Civilians were killed in Iraq. But the whole world now is angry because civilians were killed in New York. Do you think that the civilians in New York are much more valuable, their life more valuable than the life of civilians in Palestine or Iraq or Egypt or Sudan? So this double standard really makes people angry.
Nawal al-Sadawi, you wrote an unpublished essay in the last few weeks after the September 11th attacks, talking about the U.S. response as a case of the son killing the father, a story often repeated in history. Anwar Sadat of Egypt killed on October 6, 1981 by the Islamic fundamentalist group, which he created with the help of the United States. And you talk about terrorism breeding more terrorism. In these last few minutes, what do you think people need to understand as they move forward here in the United States and around the world with a war that the United States has declared. The Secretary of War, Donald Rumsfeld, the president, could go on as long as the Cold War.
Yes. Well, what I would like to say that people here in the United States needs knowledge, real knowledge about what's happening in the world, because they are misinformed by the media and even by universities and schools, you know. So people must know why there is terrorism, why this event happened, why the World Trade Center organization was selected to be bombed, you know. And we have also to remember, you know, we remember Seattle, what happened in the demonstrations in Seattle, November 1999. Thousands of people came together, regardless of their religion or color or nationality, they came together against the World Trade Organization. So it was a political attack against the World Trade Organization. Why there was a bombing to the World Trade Center. So here there is a difference, but still the message is the same. The global economic system cannot work like that. It's not fair. It's creating poverty and increasing poverty all over the world. The rich are becoming more rich, the poor are becoming more poor, and women are becoming more and more oppressed. We have this phenomenon of feminization of poverty all over the world. So this system cannot go on like that. And there must be a solution to this class patriarchal system and capitalism in order to have more equality, real democracy, and more freedom between individuals, nations, and sexes.
What are the questions your students are asking you right now at Montclair State University? You're there teaching women writers after the September 11th attacks.
I have wonderful students here in my two classes. In fact, I teach creativity, creative writing, but there is no separation between politics and literature. And in fact, some of the students are brilliant and active. We just a few days ago, we formed what we called Student Faculty Committee Against the War. And we have meetings every Monday to make political discussions, to create awareness among students and faculty in our university and in the community. So I think it's very important that academic institutions and universities play a part in increasing the knowledge and awareness of people about the original causes of the war and try to prevent it.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Nawal Sadawi, for joining us, leading Egyptian feminist, writer, psychiatrist, author of The Hidden Face of Eve, Women in the Arab World, and The Naked Face of Arab Women, currently distinguished visiting writer at Montclair State University in New Jersey. And that does it for today's program. We would love to hear from you. You can write to us at mail@democracynow.org, and we have unveiled our website. And that is www.democracynow.org, where you can hear us and you can see and go to many of the different programs we've brought you over these last months, the War and Peace Report. That's democracynow.org. We can also be heard at wbix.org and webactive.com. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Our music maestro and engineer is Anthony Sloan. Errol Maitland is at WBIX.org. Amy Parmelo at KPFA. Special thanks and Free Speech Radio news producer Aaron Glantz to everyone at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno and all our affiliate stations around the country who are airing us. We are Pacifica. And to the public access TV stations, you can call your station and ask them to air the War and Peace Report as well. Special thanks to Downtown Community Television, John Alpert, and Keiko Tsuno, and to Free Speech TV, airing us on Channel 9415 of the Dish Network. We are in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Right from the start, in a world torn apart, a baby's love, his fingerprints upon the heart. So many thinking, but
but never say it. Why bring a child to this planet full of hatred? They might not make it like the youngest departed. Worst of all, they might become a part of it. Involved in it, perpetuating violence, growing up in silence, seeing things.